Welcome to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Today is May 25th, 2016. We are in Juneau for the fourth special session. We are in the Belts Room in the Terry Miller Building, and today we have one item on the agenda. I would like to thank our recording secretary, Carrie, and the LIO operator, Cody, for making this meeting possible. I'd like to welcome Vice Chair Senator Giesel. Welcome.
Hi.
Senator Stevens, welcome. Senate President Kevin Meyer, welcome. And Senator Johnny Ellis, welcome. It's also, I don't know if I mentioned, it's 1:30, so we're being prompt today. Today we have one item on the agenda. It's House Bill 4001. It's the governor's bill to tax the income of working Alaskans, plus motor fuel, mining, marijuana, alcohol, tobacco, trusts, and fisheries. And today with us, I'd like to welcome Commissioner Hoffbeck and also Division Director Ken Alper, who are here to present the bill. In addition, we have members of the administration online, and please feel free to defer to them. I would like to let members know that we have a presentation, and I would like to give them an opportunity to go through the entire presentation and then take questions following. So with that, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue.
Hello, Madam Chair. Ken Alper, Director of the Tax Division.
Madam Chair, I'd just like to make a few real brief opening remarks, and then I will turn it over to Director Alper to walk through the provisions of the bill. As you all know, the governor, at the beginning of the regular session, introduced a package of bills that were designed to reduce expenditures, to use our financial assets in a manner to help close the fiscal gap, and also a package of new revenues. In the regular session, those new revenues were introduced as individual bills. The difference for the special session is they have now been bundled together as an omnibus tax bill that is before you today. It is one of the major components that the governor still has indicated is essential in trying to close the fiscal gap by 2019. The bill itself pulls together the income tax, HB 250 and SB 134, the motor fuel tax, HB 249 and SB 132, the tobacco tax, which is SB 133 and HB 304, alcohol tax, SB 131 and HB 248, the mining tax, SB 137, HB 253, the fish tax, SB 135, HB 251, and provisions of HB 337, which was a marijuana tax enforcement bill that was put together, was introduced by Representative Ledoux. Within the bill that's in front of you, we have incorporated as much of the committee work as that was already done on these bills as possible. There were some committee actions that were in opposition to the governor's position. Those were not necessarily included, but to the extent that we could incorporate the work that was already done, we've incorporated that into the bill and modified the governor's bill to reflect the work that has been done. This committee has already heard three of the bills that are on there, the income tax, the cigarette tax, and the alcohol tax. Although, as Director Alper will explain, the cigarette tax is different than the one that you had originally heard. It's based more on the House version of the bill. Together, these bills would raise about $350 million in revenue. The structure of the presentation is fairly simple. There'll be two slides for each of the taxes. The first slide will talk about what the bill does and then how it differs from what was heard in the regular, that was first introduced in the regular session. And then the second slide will be how much money does it raise and how does it impact Alaskans. There was provisions within the original bill that dealt with electronic filing. Of course, that was taken care of within HB 375, and so those provisions have been stripped out of the bills and are no longer part of the package. And with that, I will turn it over to Director Alper to walk through the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I can't tell you how much of a pleasure it is to be in a regular legislative space for the first time in a few weeks. Like Commissioner Hoffbeck said, we have two slides on each of the different taxes. There's no magic to the sequence. We're using the order in which they appear in the bill, which is the statutory sequence. The income tax would be a new chapter. Title 43, Section 22. And it's very similar to the income tax that we saw in your committee earlier in the session. It's a tax at 6% of an individual or a household's federal tax liability. In other words, if they paid $100 to the federal government in a given year, it would be a $6 tax to the state of Alaska. Now, this is a very similar structure to the historic income tax that Alaska had for some decades until it was repealed until 1980. Our former tax reached as high as 16% at one point, so about three times the size of the tax being proposed here. In addition to being the tax, it has language relating to withholding by employers, an annual form like a W-2 for the state level that would be of the individual's withholding, and the language would include, it says out-of-state income, that's not really worded artfully, the income of out-of-state residents, of course, all the income earned in Alaska, regardless of residence, as well as the income earned in Alaska by partners and S-corporations. We did make some changes, and I was a little bit disappointed that once I wrote this presentation, I learned that one of them didn't actually make it in as an edit. So we have done our best to remove the language relating to taxation of trusts. Alaska has some substantial role as a trust haven. We don't want to upend that in any way with any new income tax. So to the extent we could, we've removed that language from the bill. We also attempted to remove this is really in the withholding tax, that the fisheries crew would have their taxes withheld as if they were regular employees. Most crew members are not regular employees. They're contract employees. They get 1099s. We heard from the fishing industry that would be onerous to handle withholding on their behalf, and that we asked to have it removed. The draft of the bill, the original A version of 4001 behind you, does not have that removal, although we thought it did. And should the bill progress, we would hope and support that we would remove those fisheries withholding languages. But the most important change is the delay in the effective date.
Thank you. And we've been joined by Senator Machicki. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The bill that was presented in the regular session was relatively immediate. It would have started withholding in January of 2017 with the first tax returns due in early 2018. This is a full year's deferral. That does several things. First off, it gives us a year to get it right, to get the systems in place, the software, the vendors. There's just a lot of unknowns that we would like to get some outside consulting services to learn what it's going to take to build an income tax from scratch. There are a number of small states that have done it in the last few years, and we'd be looking for them for more information. The other thing it does is it takes some of the big early implementation costs out of this bill. We don't have a big capital request or any request for substantial additional staffing. We would have put together an implementation plan should this bill pass as written and come back in January with the costs needed to build the system to be ready for withholding in January of 2018. All that we've asked for in this bill is a one-time appropriation for some outside research and then a single new staff to head up the project within the tax division. The bill before you was always a $200 million bill. It doesn't bring in its full amount until its second fiscal year in operation because it's inherently a calendar year tax. So taking effect in 2018 January means through the withholding process we'll bring in about half the annual amount in FY18, in the last 6 months of FY18, and then the full amount, it's actually $205 million per our latest formulas in FY19. And Madam Chair, you'll recall the governor's statement from the beginning was he wanted to develop a balanced budget by FY19. So this still meets the governor's goal of getting everything in place by that fiscal year. We show small increases in the revenues beginning in FY20 just tied to population growth and inflation, that sort of thing. About 20 to 30% of Alaskans will have no liability. That was a conversation we had in this committee. We initially thought that would be a somewhat higher number. The national figure is more in the 40s. About 45% of Americans have zero federal income tax burden. The reason Alaskans it would be a smaller number is, you know, first off, we are a higher income state just because of the cost of living here, and our wages are higher in this state. So there, and the federal tax rates are have income triggers that are not aren't regionalized. There's no balance for cost of living, and also, frankly, our permanent fund dividend that becomes something of a basic income for all households, and that helps push people into at least a minimal tax bracket at the federal level. And that reduces the percentage of Alaskans that would have no tax liability. The bill before you would have very, very little tax liability if for a family that makes less than $50,000. We went through some of these numbers during the regular session. If substantially less than 1% of income for almost everyone. You have to get really over $100,000 before the tax would reach more than 1% of your income. By absorbing the federal tax code, this becomes a progressive tax at the same rate that the federal tax code is. So if a person's paying at the 39% rate to the federal government, we're at 6% of that. If they're paying at the 10% to the federal government, we're at 6% of that. Another important provision of this sort of income tax is that state income taxes are deductible for those Alaskans who itemize. Primarily, that would be all homeowners with mortgages. They would be able to deduct their state income tax from their federal income tax and save at their marginal tax rate, 20, 25, 30% of whatever they paid the state. They would be able to reduce their payments to the federal government, and the U.S. government would be paying some portion of that $200 million indirectly. There are 43 states who currently have an income tax. Only 41 of them are true income taxes, meaning they tax all income. The other two just tax capital gains. And of those 41, 42 with us, we would be the lowest income tax rate in the country should this bill pass the way that it's written. Moving on to the motor fuel tax, I'm on slide 7, 4340. The motor fuel tax is a very similar bill to what was heard in other committees in the Senate. It is an increase of the highway fuel, the gasoline and diesel fuel, from 8 to 16 cents per gallon. Marine fuel also doubling from 5 to 10. The aviation fuel, that's general aviation, not jet fuel, 4.7 goes to 7, and the jet fuel, which is currently taxed at 3.2 cents, would go to 6.5. There is an existing credit for off-road highway fuel. This is claimed by primarily large industrial users like miners who might have a lot of vehicles that are used off the road system. They can currently get 6 of their 8 cents back on their bulk fuel purchases. That's being doubled to 12 cents in this bill. So they would go from an effective 2 cent to a 4 cent tax in keeping with the general doubling of the system. The key differences between this and the regular session bill is the aviation numbers. There was a work draft in the House Finance Committee that reduced some of those numbers. They were the only pieces that were more than doubled. So we absorbed their changes from that work draft committee substitute for the House Companion 249. So we had originally proposed a 10-cent rate for both aviation and jet fuel, and you see on this slide the lower rates. The other piece, the Senate Transportation Committee, suggested that this tax should sunset in 2 years in fiscal year 18, and then bring it before the legislature to look to renew it. There was also a price trigger that it would automatically sunset. Those provisions are not in the draft before you. This would be perceived as a permanent change to the motor fuel tax.
Thank you, and we've been joined by Representative Hughes and Representative Wilson. Thank you. And we've also been joined by Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chairman, you have a very popular committee today.
Well, it has a lot of taxes in it, so I'm sure there's a lot of interest.
The motor fuel component of the tax bill would be about $43 million per year. This would just about double what we currently get from the motor fuel taxes. Of that number, $200,000 would be shared with municipalities who have municipally owned airports just because of existing provisions of law that talk about aviation taxes collected from on municipal airports. And this is a tax that has not increased in many years. The highway portion, the 8-cent highway tax, was last increased in 1970. Obviously, the underlying price of fuel is dramatically different than it was in 1970. So as an overall portion of the fuel rate, our 8-cent tax has shrank dramatically. Even doubling it to 16, we would still have the lowest, I believe, or one of the lowest rates in the country. And just to put it in real-world perspective, average driver who might drive 12,000 miles in a year in a vehicle gets 20 miles per gallon. That's 600 gallons of fuel per year. That would be an additional $48 in fuel taxes paid to the state of Alaska by that typical driver based on this tax increase, $48. The next component is our tobacco tax. This is one of the pieces that was in the Labor and Commerce Committee during the regular session. We had a couple of hearings on the changes to AS 4350. This is, for the most part, also an increase to existing tax rates. The tax rate on cigarettes is measured in mils. That's just a mil is a thousandth of a dollar, so it's really cents per cigarette. And our current rate is 10 cents per cigarette. We're looking to increase it to 15, or for the buyer of a pack of cigarettes, the stamp on the bottom of a pack of cigarettes is a state tax stamp. That would go up from being a $2 stamp to a $3 stamp, our share of a pack of cigarettes. Other tobacco products, that's a broad definition that includes everything from cigars, chewing tobacco, and rolled tobacco. All of that would go from 75% of its wholesale value to 100% of wholesale value. We're creating a new category called electronic smoking products. Those are currently untaxed, and we're adding a new tax at 75% of the wholesale value. This is a growing industry that's really blossomed in the last few years. We currently know very little about it. We don't know numbers. We don't know volumes. We have an indeterminate fiscal impact of that tax, but we believe it's important to get them under the umbrella as a tobacco or quasi-tobacco product, as also being taxed by the state. There's a definition change related to some audit history, some issues we've had with taxpayers in the past that cleans up the definition of wholesale price. That's a little bit outside the scope of the bill, but it's something we need for the underlying tobacco tax. This is the one bill in the governor's package that was different between what was introduced in the House and Senate. The Senate bill was introduced first. We were working on some language, and it evolved some, and it had to do with the definition of electronic smoking product. Well, we used the House bill as the starting point because it more closely reflected what we were trying to do. We were working with your staff, Madam Chair, to amend the original regular session bill to look more like the House, and we've incorporated that amendment. The other major change is the e-smoking has been carved out into a separate tax rather being lumped in with other tobacco products, so it's being taxed at a different rate. And we're limiting that to only products that contain nicotine. There was some argument that people use the vape systems for non-tobacco uses, and the decision was made to carve those out. What that does require, though, is labeling. Right now, we don't have any labeling requirement. We would need some mechanism to prove, in fact, that something does or doesn't contain nicotine. We don't anticipate sending these things to a lab, so we're going to need to be working with industry to make sure that we're only taxing what we want to tax. The changes in this legislation are $29 million a year. That's about a 50% increase over the current collections. Our tobacco tax is one of them that we do foresee declining from year to year, simply because there are fewer smokers in Alaska from year to year. The younger generation does not smoke at the same rates as the older generation, and hopefully someday this will be a tax that collects zero, but there's nothing really we could do about that. I mentioned there's...
Excuse me, I'd like to interrupt you just to say that Representative Olson has also been with us for a while.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I said a few minutes ago, there is no indeterminate revenue from the e-cigarette portion. The $29 million is purely from the formulaic change to the cigarette and other tobacco products. Of that number, because of some existing statutory formulas in the cigarette tax, about $2 million would go to the Tobacco Use Education and Cessation Fund, another fund within the budget. How does this impact Alaskans? It will make it more expensive to smoke. Our cigarette tax is relatively high by American standards. We have the 11th highest, and this would bump us to the 5th highest cigarette tax rate. There are, however, substantial tobacco-related health costs that the state incurs through the state-funded health system. Dr. Butler has testified in both Labor and Commerce committees about that during the session, and this will help offset some of those costs. We are also adding a tax for the first time to this new vape or e-smoking industry, which is a new thing. The alcohol tax, AS 4360, is a pretty straightforward excise tax. It would double the current rates on all categories of alcoholic beverages. Just to sort of pause for a second, this was last addressed by the legislature in 2002. At that point, there was another budgetary shortfall, and the system that legislature settled on was the idea of a dime a drink, meaning whatever the official portion is for alcoholic beverages, we're going to set the tax to be 10 cents for each portion. For example, there are 128 ounces in a gallon. A shot or a one-ounce portion of distilled spirits is considered a portion. Therefore, our excise current tax is $12.80 for a gallon, and we're looking to double that to 20 cents a drink, $25.60 per gallon, or roughly $5 per 750-milliliter standard bottle of liquor. Wine is roughly a 5-ounce pour in a glass of wine, so that's $2.50 per gallon, would be going to $5, again, about 50 cents on a standard bottle of wine going up to a dollar. Beer and cider is now $1.07 per gallon, roughly 10 cents for 12-ounce portion, doubling to $2.14. And then there is the exemption for what they call small craft breweries. This is a federal designation. It's those breweries who produce less than 2 million barrels a year. It's, frankly, most of the breweries in the country, but not the big three ones like, say, Budweiser. The limitation is only the first 60,000 barrels per year sold in Alaska from one of those small craft brewers comes in at the lower rate, which is at about one-third of the full rate. I believe the original desire when this was carved in 15 years ago was to create this exemption for Alaskan breweries, but there were constitutional issues with that. So instead, the exemption goes to all small brewery beer from all over the world. Meanwhile, I mentioned the 10 cent per drink tax goes to 20. And the other change has to do also with some internal housekeeping provisions of ours. Right now, there's a fixed $25,000 bond for all alcohol taxpayers. That's a little bit onerously large for some of the smaller ones, like some of the local craft breweries, and quite small and not being much of a protection for the state for some of the larger distributors. We would like the ability to set this by regulation and have some discretion on the tax division to set what the bonding requirement should be for individual alcohol taxpayers. And this bill is not different in any way from the regular session bill that you heard in this committee earlier in the year. Slide number 12 looks at the how much is it raised, $40 million per year. I do want to point out an error of mine in the fiscal note that you should have in your packet. The 2017, the FY17 number is listed at $4 million in the table on the back. It should be 40, and then the summary total on the front page of that fiscal note should be increased by $36 million, the difference between 4 and 40. I'm sorry that we missed that in the getting together of the fiscal note. But $40 million would double our current tax collections. No great mystery there. We're doubling all the tax rates. We're going to double the taxes. And of that $40 million, half goes currently, and of the new $40 million, another half, $20 million, would go to the Alcohol and Other Drug Abuse Treatment and Prevention Fund. This is a fund that's within the mental health budget. However, it's supplemented by a lot of GF. It does not mean that we would be spending $20 million more necessarily on these alcohol and other drug abuse functions. That GF could easily be backed out at the legislature's discretion if the desire was to use these as general funds. Obviously, this makes it more expensive to drink. And we have to say, and it's true, that we have the first or second highest alcohol tax rates in the country. And this would make us even more so the highest. There's a little bit of a caveat to that. Only 33 states actually tax alcoholic beverages. The other 17 have state-owned liquor stores, which means it's hard to discern the tax rate. It's sort of built into their regulated retail prices, and we don't actually know the tax rates in those 17 states. Madam Chair, that's it for the alcohol tax. Moving on to the marijuana, this is a piece that had not previously been seen in the Senate. This was a House bill that passed out of the Labor and Commerce Committee and was in finance that Representative Ledoux introduced that brings up some concepts that we had talked about related to some of the marijuana bills that we're moving. We are not changing the marijuana tax. The initiative set a $50 per ounce excise tax. We have, in the regulatory process, changed the way that a little bit, meaning that certain of the non-smokable portions of the plant will have lower tax rate. Those are the products that are going to be bought in bulk and going into the concentrates industry, the liquids that go into the edibles industry. But what we are doing in this bill is adding a surety bond, a $5,000 bond. The taxpayers in marijuana are the growers, are the cultivators, who then sell that product to either a manufacturing facility or a retailer. That cultivator is paying that $50 tax. We want to get some sort of a bond to ensure that they pay their taxes. This is an unusual bond only because there's some expectation that a substantial number of the marijuana taxpayers will be paying in cash. A lot of their business will be conducted in cash, and therefore we need the ability to give their bond in cash as opposed to a surety, which is more of a type of insurance policy that typically a taxpayer would use for this type of function. The real powers in this bill are the ability to enforce the tax against a retailer who's selling unlicensed product. This is a term in the tax world called secondary liability. It currently exists in our alcohol and tobacco statutes. In other words, if we find a tobacco store is selling bootleg cigarettes that were brought in from overseas at out of state and taxes weren't paid, we can force that retailer to pay the alcohol, the cigarette tax, as if they were a wholesaler. It's an important enforcement tool that we have in alcohol and tobacco, and we're looking to extend it to marijuana. I think this is particularly important because in marijuana, there is still a black market industry and a somewhat robust one in Alaska. And we want to do everything we can to shut that down and ensure that the Alaska that's sold through Alaska's recreational stores is grown and taxed and regulated legally through Alaska's regulated recreational marijuana growers. So this power, it gives us a little bit of enforcement to ensure that. The second additional power has to do with illegal growers themselves, that if someone is caught with a grow operation, there's a legal limit to the number of plants an individual could have for personal use. There's something of a legal gray area beyond that. The criminal statutes remain on the books in Title 11 relating to possession of large amounts of marijuana. Those may or may not be enforced in that circumstance. What we're offering as an alternative is a tax penalty to say we can, through a civil fine, collect $50 an ounce or per ounce equivalent for the marijuana someone might have in an illegal grow operation. A couple of months ago, there was a large grow that was caught in Homer. There were 1,000 plants in a warehouse. That person did not have a license. I don't believe he was ever arrested for anything. There was no evidence of selling it. It's something of, once again, a legal gray area. But that amount of marijuana would have resulted in about a $250,000 tax penalty had this provision been in place at the time. This is the full language from the committee substitute that came out of the House Labor and Commerce Committee to Representative Ledoux's bill. There is no known revenue amount, a little bit of indeterminate revenue. If these enforcement actions lead to anything, we'll collect a little bit of tax. We hope to not have to. We hope to be able to use this as a deterrent and not be able to chase people for money. But the big picture idea is we want to make it advantageous. If Alaska is going to take the step and legalize recreational marijuana, we want to make it advantageous to be taxed and legal and regulated and disadvantageous to remain in the black market. Hopefully that will divert more of the market itself into the legal industry and increase the revenue that comes to the state through the marijuana excise tax. Moving on to mining. This is one that was not in your committee, Madam Chair. This was in the Resources Committee, your Vice Chair's committee. This increases the top tax rate on profits above $100,000 per year for miners in Alaska from 7% to 9%. This is a bracketed tax, meaning the first $100,000 in income would be unchanged, only that income greater than $100,000. There is also a tax holiday or a waiver in existing statute that says a new mine is not taxed for its first 3 1/2 years of operation. That number is archaic. It goes back 60 or more years, and it's a little bit awkward in that the mining tax is a true annual tax. There are no monthly tax payments. It's based on annual income. So we can't quite understand how one even handles a 3 1/2 year waiver. Reducing it to a round number is essential. Reducing it to 2 years is the number that we think is reasonable, given the fiscal situation. The other thing done in this bill is right now there is an exploration incentive credit that mines earn during their early exploration phase. Capitalized expenditures that are carried forward, to differentiate this from, say, oil and gas, where there's the ability to cash out certain credits. The mining credit has to be held and carried until there's a future tax liability. But those exploration credits can currently be used not just against the tax, but also against mining royalties, should the state be the royalty holder, the landowner, for a particular mine. This bill prevents that and says, no, these credits can only be used against the tax, not against the royalty. We're also adding a $50 license fee for miners. This is one that will affect all of the miners, including the small ones. Right now, mining is one of a handful of industries in Alaska that have a blanket exemption from our Business License Act. They are not required to have business licenses. A business license in Alaska costs $50 a year for pretty much any other kind of business. We're not looking for them to get a second license. They already have a mining license, so we don't need to create a new bureaucracy for them. But we do think it's reasonable that they pay the same $50 fee for their license that other businesses in Alaska do for theirs. How is this different from the regular session bill? We initially sought a complete elimination of the tax holiday, set it to zero. This bill reduces it to 2 years rather than 3 1/2. And the the change I just described about the exploration incentive credit, that was an amendment that came out of the House Resources Committee and their committee substitute. We thought it was a good idea, and we've incorporated that language in the governor's bill draft for the mining license tax change. Right now, some of the commodity prices are quite depressed. The numbers that this bill raises are less than we would have forecasted back in the fall when we were first putting these bills together. But it's about a $7 million a year increase. Of that, about $25,000 will come from these $50 license fees for the few hundred licensed miners in Alaska. To be clear, the tax increase at the top bracket is only going to actually impact a small number of taxpayers. In 2014, there were only 14 taxpayers who came in over the $100,000 line. And of them, many of them were very close to $100,000, say less than $200,000. So it would be a quite small tax impact on them. A few of them were quite a bit larger, of course. There are five large mines in the state of Alaska. That's who would be paying the great bulk, probably 99% of this tax increase. The rest are the placer miners, the small mom-and-pop miners who happen to have a good year and make more than $100,000. Those tend to move up and down from year to year depending on how much they mine that year. But when they get over $100,000, they'd face a small tax increase. There's also, interestingly, a number of landowners, private landowners who own land under one or more of our large mines. The royalties received by a private landowner is itself considered a mining income that's subject to the mining license tax. So some of these taxpayers are actually landowners who collect a lot of royalties, and they're paying a tax on their royalty to the state. And once again, this does not, other than the $50, impact your mom-and-pop miners. The last tax in the bill before you is the fisheries tax. We're changing sections of both the fisheries business tax, which is primarily processors in Alaska, and then the fisheries landing tax, which is primarily fish caught in federal waters that are landed in Alaska for export. Those fisheries are taxed at a percentage point level. It's a percentage of the raw fish value, sometimes called the raw fish tax. Generally between 3 and 5%, and we're increasing all of those by 1 percentage point. So a 4 becomes a 5, a 5 becomes a 6. Canneries are oddly taxed at 4.5%. That's something that's been in statute for a long time. That goes to 5.5%. And the key is that the entire 1% increment is state general funds. Right now we have robust revenue sharing language in the fish tax statutes that say half of all of it goes to the affected municipality where the fish is caught or landed. So landed and processed, not caught. That itself is a dispute within the fishing industry that I don't want to get into. So the way the bill is written is the 1% increment, the first 1% of tax, goes entirely to the state. The remaining amount continues to be split 50-50. So the municipalities are held harmless. They are not impacted pro or con by this. The entire 1% increase goes to the state. This does also remove within the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission statutes, they have a formula for what their annual fee is for their entry permits. That's tied to the value of the permit itself. It's a percentage calculation. However, there's a cap on it of $3,000 per year. This bill eliminates that cap. What that would do is increase the fees for certain large and valuable boats and the large and valuable fisheries. For the most part, there's about 200 taxpayers, almost all of them non-resident, who would be paying additional entry fees under this particular provision. Now, there are, within the fish tax statutes, what they call developing fisheries. That's a determination made by the Commissioner of Fish and Game annually that certain fisheries considered developing, meaning low volume, new, small participation, what have you, meet certain criteria. Those fisheries are typically taxed at a lower rate, and they are exempted from the increase. They're very small volume numbers. I mean, it's a tens of thousands of dollar question versus the millions that are in the bill. How is this different from what we originally introduced? One of the developing fisheries was raised from 3 to 4%. There was no specific reason for that. It just sort of happened, and we thought for consistency, all of the developing fisheries should be exempted. And also the permit fee change, was part of a work draft to a committee substitute in the House Finance Committee that we have adopted that into our bill. It was not part of our original request. I believe there might have been some other standalone legislation, if not this year, in prior years, that also would have removed the CFEC cap on the entry permits. How much money are we talking about? $20 million total in the bill. 18 of it coming from the tax change itself, the raw fish and landing tax rates, and about $2 million a year from the commercial fisheries fee change. This is an unusual tax. You know, to distinguish it from most anything else that we're talking about in this bill, like alcohol and tobacco, there is no way for the market to necessarily absorb a tax increase in fisheries. These are commodities. They tend to be set by a market price that's outside the local jurisdiction. So it means that the processors themselves would have to absorb that increase, and to the extent they can, they would be passing it on back up their supply chain to their harvesters, to the individual fishermen who they purchase their fish from. And you will hear it from the fishing industry in prior testimony, and I'm sure in future testimony if they're asked, that the fisherman pays this tax indirectly anyway, whereas the taxpayer is actually our customer from the tax division's point of view is the process. Slide 19 starts the sectional analysis. It runs in a fairly consistent pattern. What I've tried to do is underline in each section what part of the bill we're talking about. It hops around a little bit just because of some of the conforming language. The CFEC statutes, for example, are separate from the fish tax statute. So that CFEC cap happens to be in Section 1 of the bill. It's in Title 16. The bond relating to our new bond for marijuana taxpayers is a condition of issuing a marijuana license, so therefore it shows up in the marijuana licensing statutes in Title 17. Sections 3 through 6 are all about the mining royalty in DNR statutes in Title 27, and the conforming language that the mining exploration incentive credit can't be used against the royalty. It can still, of course, be used against the tax. Section 7 is a big new section that actually adds the income tax. This is, for the most part, identical to the income tax standalone bill that your committee saw earlier. I think it was Senate Bill 134. 4322.010 creates the tax itself, resident and non-resident individuals, 6%, all the language that creates the tax itself. 020 is the credit for taxes paid to another jurisdiction. The most complex part of administering a state income tax is multi-state individuals and making sure that their income and their liability is apportioned properly, and O2O is effectively the mechanisms by which we handle that. Credits paid to other states, and they have credits paid against us, and we manage to work out what's the appropriate share based on where the income comes from. 030 is the annual return, the requirement to file your taxes with dates attached. They have to attach a copy of the IRS return, and we're authorized to pay them refunds of overpaid taxes. This is fairly standard administration language. And typically, more and more Americans pay their taxes using one or more pieces of software, TurboTax, or through a paid provider like H&R Block. It is very typical that those companies and those software packages have the ability to fill out the state tax simultaneously with the federal tax. It's not much of an additional burden, and it generally costs about $20 to file your state taxes through one of these mechanisms. 04 defines the sources of income subject to the tax. That's always going to be controversial, but we tried to make it as broad as possible. 050 is the withholding section. We are going to be withholding taxes for wage-earning Alaskans in-state, putting that burden on employers to withhold taxes and submit to the state monthly, much as they currently do the FICA taxes to the Internal Revenue Service. It's a relatively standard part of being an employer with waged employees. 060 gives us the power to administer it, and we need some definitions. So that's the income tax, and it's all packed into one section because it's a new chapter. Sections 8 and 9, meanwhile, that's the motor fuel tax. That's a relatively simple change because we're just changing some numbers. Section 10 is the motor fuel credit, the off-road credit that I mentioned. The tobacco section-wise is the longest portion of the bill, primarily because we're adding this new thing called electronic smoking products. Embedded with that are not just definitions, but also a lot of conforming language. Where we're talking about tobacco or cigarettes, we have to add a lot of and electronic smoking products or electronic smoking products to a number of different sections just for administration and consistency purposes. So there's a lot of sections that touch upon the tobacco tax, and I can go into them all. Allowing us to share information with municipalities, conforming language to reference the new definition, the cigarette tax is the cigarette tax increase itself. And that language in Section 13, the additional tax levy, that's an oddity in our existing statute. Right now, although I described earlier we have a 100 mil cigarette tax, we actually have two cigarette taxes, a 38 mil cigarette tax and a 62 mil additional cigarette tax. The 38 mil tax is older, and that's the one that has the stamp attached to it, and that goes entirely to the school fund. We are not touching that one. We are touching the additional tax and raising it from 62 to 112. Net effect is the same. We're going from 100 to 150. Meanwhile, that Section 14 is the tax on other tobacco products. Section 15 is the new tax on electronic smoking products at 75%. Section 16 is a more e-smoking conforming language regarding federal exemptions. 17, 18, 19, 20, all conforming language relating to electronic smoking products and adding them to certain administration functions, monthly returns, licensing, that kind of thing. Section 21, there's been some discussion of this. There's some debate as to whether or not e-smoking is a tobacco cessation product, if it's used not as almost a health product to help people quit smoking. We have language that says if the federal government says that something is a smoking cessation product, for example, a nicotine patch already is, we do not tax that, even though it contains, we can't call a nicotine patch another tobacco product because it has this cessation product waiver on it. If any products get that waiver, we have to add electronic smoking products to those definitions as well. We could not pay taxes on it. Meanwhile, Section 22, this is the definition of wholesale price. This is the housekeeping change. The wholesale price should be the gross invoice price, including all federal excise taxes, less any trade discounts or other reductions. And the issue has had to do with these trade discounts in the past. Section 23 is the definition of electronic smoking product. That specifies that it doesn't include nicotine. It also includes the labeling requirement, I believe, is all in Section 23. Section 24, now we're into the alcohol tax. That's the rate itself that I described. When I said distilled spirits earlier, that is not a term defined in statute. What it actually says is products with an alcohol content of greater than 21%. So theoretically below that, it becomes wine, although there's no there's a little bit of a gray area there as well. But most liquor, so to speak, is 40% alcohol, so 21% gets a lot of the liqueurs, the blended liquors and that kind of thing. So wine is 250 to 5, greater than 21 is 1280 to 2560. Malt beverages and ciders, colloquially beer, $7 to 214. And then Section 25 is the reduced tax rate for the craft breweries. The craft brewery exemption first, 60,000 barrels sold. Section 26, I mentioned this earlier, this changes the language of the state bonding requirement for alcoholic beverage taxpayers, making it a more discretionary number of hours. Section 27, now we're on marijuana. This is the monthly filing of marijuana taxes. This conforms the marijuana tax language that passed in the initiative to the e-filing bill that passed earlier this session. The 28 is the $50 tax penalty for the excess possession, the Homer situation that I mentioned, and also the liability for the marijuana retailer to pay the $50 excise tax if they have untaxed product, and the bonding requirement. The guts of the marijuana changes are Section 28. The mining tax, Section 29 is the exemption, the two-year exemption from 3.5. Section 30 is the main tax change, the 2% increase from 7 to 9 on the highest bracket. The Section 31 is the mining license fee, the $50 per year. Section 32 is the fisheries tax. That changes those tax rates I described earlier. And Section 33 parallels Section 32, although it's set up for direct marketers. A direct marketer, for the most part, is a harvester who sells his own fish rather than selling it through a processor, and they pay at the same rate as the processors do. Section 34 conforms with the electronic filing changes. There's some interesting archaic language there that says they have to submit their returns to the department at Juneau. Obviously, if they're paying on the internet is not in Juneau, and they could pay it wherever the internet is. Section 35 is the establishes that 1% is diverted to entirely general fund and exempted from that shared tax, municipal tax sharing provision that's elsewhere in statute. Section 36 is in the fisheries landing tax, which is a different chapter than the fisheries business tax, but it's the same effect, the 1% increase and in keeping it harmless for the developing species. Sections 37 and 38 are the tax sharing 1% waiver within the landing tax section. Again, there's a lot of parallels between the business and landing taxes, but you have to do it twice. Section 39, now we're into the uncodified and the repealers and all of the end of the bill stuff. There's some language on the tobacco tax that has some conditional, you know, what happens if a certain thing goes away, what happens to the mill rate that needed to get amended for the tobacco tax increase. There's an old credit relating to, believe it or not, political donations used to be deductible from the state income tax in Alaska. We thought it wise to remove that from the statutes. It's still out there from 35 years ago. We're simply repealing it. The applicability language, this is important that we want the tax increases to apply to only products sold after the effective date, not taxes paid after the effective date. It's really clarification language in Section 41. The bonding requirement as a prerequisite to get the marijuana licenses in 42 and how that's treated by ABC and by us. The mining exploration credits and the royalties, there's a transition language there. There's sort of a how does it get from A to B. That's covered in 43. The regulation writing authorizations in 44, and there's multiple departments touched by this bill, not just revenue, and you can see them listed here, natural resources because of the mining bonds, fish and game because of the fish tax, CFEC because of their licensing, and of course the Marijuana Control Board, which is a overseen by the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. So the marijuana regulations are made retroactive to the day marijuana became legal, February 25th, 2015. That date is simply 90 days after the initiative vote was certified after the 2014 general election. 47 and 48 makes the marijuana statute changes also retroactive to that effective date. And then the delayed effective date on the income tax in Section 48 and the immediate effective date for writing the regulations and then the real effective date for the rest of the bill, July 1st, 2016. And there you have our omnibus tax bill, 7 pieces in one. And I'm sure your committee has questions to ask.
Thank you very much, Mr. Alper. Appreciate you going through the bill so thoroughly and also the sectional for the committee. You know, where to start? So my first question is for Commissioner Hoffbeck. So, and for those Alaskans who are listening online, this is the governor's plan that involves taxing working Alaskans, taxing Alaskans who drive, taxing Alaskans who mine, taxing Alaskans who use marijuana, taxing Alaskans who might have a beer after work or at a wedding or whatever, taxing Alaskans who smoke cigarettes, and taxing Alaskans who are involved in fisheries. And it's in a comprehensive bill before us today. Yet, despite the comprehensive nature of the bill, it addresses a mere 5% of our $4 billion deficit. So my question is, why bother?
Madam Chair, for the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner Revenue. I think it's like all of the pieces within the governor's plan. This would address about $350 million in revenue. We made cuts to the budget, you know, $200-$400 million, same kind of percentage of the whole issue. And, you know, it's just a lot of small pieces adding up to a substantial amount in the end. Of course, the biggest piece is the Permanent Fund Protection Act, which is the largest driver in getting us to a solution. But the governor wanted to spread the burden of balancing the budget in as many ways as he possibly could, and the revenue package is just one of those pieces.
You had mentioned the Permanent Fund Protection Act, so that's a major part of the plan. If that doesn't pass, can Alaskans expect that these taxes will just skyrocket and increase if this were to pass?
Madam Chair, that is not the governor's plan. The plan is that we do have to have, as part of the package, some systematic way of using our wealth to fund government services. And so the idea is that that has to be a piece of it. We are not looking to rely on taxes alone to balance the budget. You know, we do have that.
I should hope not.
You know, we have a benefit that other states don't have. We do have a lot of wealth. We do have savings that generate substantial income. And as we transition from a state that was primarily funded by oil and gas revenues, which in the past have been as much as 85% or 90%, that are now looking at being more in the range of 25% to 30% as we go forward, just because we have lower prices and lower production, and that's our large extent our future. I mean, we are on the backside of our tax, our oil and gas production. That we need the Permanent Fund Protection Act and using our earnings as a substantial piece moving forward, and it gives us a situation where we don't have to rely heavily on taxing individual Alaskans to provide those government services, but there is some component of it that does need to rely on individual taxation, and the governor's tried to hold that to a minimum, but it is part of the long-term plan.
If the governor's income tax plan does pass, can he guarantee that the income, you know, the tax wouldn't go up?
Madam Chair, again, the tax that's in place was the idea of it was the last piece that was added to the plan. We looked at what were reasonable level of cuts that could be made, how much could we generate from the Permanent Fund Protection Act, how much could we generate from these other taxes, and the income tax was kind of the last piece, and we needed another $200 million to bring it into balance, and so that it was set at the $200 million or 6% of your federal liability. The plan is not to put it in place and then just immediately start to ratchet the tax up. Can we guarantee that in 5 or 10 or 15 years that this tax won't change? You know, every legislative session is different. Every legislature faces different fiscal situations. No, there's no guarantee that that's all it will ever be.
And I have one final question before I'm going to go to committee members. The legislature has seen a few of these tax proposals in this session, and the governor was not able to secure the votes for passage. What likelihood do you see a bill passing that has every single tax that he's proposing in one piece of legislation?
Madam Chair, that's a really good question, and it's one that we really debated before we ever introduced the bills in the original session. We debated whether it should be an omnibus bill or individual tax bills. We felt that people would find it easier to work with the pieces individually, and so that's how we introduced it in the regular session. One of the things that happened, of course, is the taxes got scattered, and they were in different committees and at different places within the process, and we found resistance from some legislators that might be willing to vote on a tax that they weren't real comfortable with if they knew that the other taxes were going to pass as well, but were not willing to move on a tax that they didn't like when the other bills maybe hadn't caught up to those. So we felt like the only way to keep them in together in a package so that they've moved together and people could deal with them as a whole was to put them within a single package for the special session. Obviously, the legislature can break them out if they choose to do so, but at least they will be together and can be considered as a whole, which became, I think, something important that we saw in order to move the package.
Have you found one legislator who would support this bill as written today?
Madam Chair, I have not polled the whole legislature to know.
Have you polled half the legislature?
We've talked with a large number of legislators. I think nobody's committing to anything right now. I think people see the need that a revenue package has to be part of the solution long term. But have I talked to anybody that said, oh, this is the best thing I've ever seen, I really want to do this? Nobody wants to do taxes. The governor doesn't want to do taxes, but it is part of what we need for the final fiscal solution. So, no, I can't tell you that there's anybody out there that's saying, yes, I would vote for this as a whole.
So if you were to advise the committee in our efforts here, I mean, if you were to pull out two or three and say these are the ones that we really feel have, you know, some support perhaps, could you identify a few for us? Or?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure that I could necessarily pull them out for the ones that have support, but certainly the motor fuel tax moved further than some of the other taxes did. There seemed to be more support for that in the regular session. There seemed to be some support for the cigarette tax. Obviously, the marijuana tax has moved forward. The ones that didn't move very fast was the income tax. That one bogged down pretty quickly. The alcohol tax bogged down pretty quickly. The mining and fisheries had a lot of hearings. I think it moved out of most of the original committees, but with a lot of debate. And so there was mixed response to the taxes.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'd like to go to committee members. Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Like you, I'm not sure where to start, but we'll do it in sequence that was presented. So I'm just going to ask one question at this point and let other committee members ask their questions. I'll start with the income tax. Commissioner or Director, whichever of you wants to answer. On page 6, you say it will raise $100 million in FY18 and about $200 million in FY19. When I go to the fiscal note, I'm looking at implementation costs, and it says here the department, the first sentence, says the department is requesting 500, that's 500,000?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so half of it, half of the first year's income, I'll call it income, it's not really income, it's taking from people who had income, but regardless, is actually going to be the cost of implementing. And then you'll be coming back for full cost of implementing later. So what do you anticipate being the actual, air quotes, income?
Madam Chair, through the record, Senator Giesel, the $500,000 is half of 1% of $100 million. So it's 1/200th of the money that's coming in is what we're asking for. And we're actually asking that. We're asking for the $500,000, I think, in the FY17 capital budget, and we wouldn't see any income until FY18, $100 million. That $500,000 is an estimate, and we hope not to spend all of it, but that would be for a contractor or consultant to come in to help us develop an implementation plan. We really don't have the in-house expertise to build an income tax and all of the components that it's going to take. I can tell you what was in the earlier version of the fiscal note for the governor's income tax bill. We asked for a $14 million capital appropriation, 28 times higher, and a staffing plan that added up at its full implementation about 3 years into about 60 new state employees with an annual cost of $7 or $8 million a year. But we were basing that on some very preliminary analysis, talking to other states that have done this, and also talking to our existing software vendor for our tax handling software. With the luxury of a one-year delay, we don't want to pin ourselves down to numbers like that, so we asked for a much smaller number, only a 1/28th, about 4% of the money, so that we can go out and find out what the actual costs are going to be, come back to the legislature in 2017 with probably another piece of legislation or simply a capital appropriation that says we need this to build and implement the income tax program, and also we need to start hiring people for it. So once again, we're only asking for a one-time $500,000 and one employee to be our project director that would obviously be a senior person if there ends up being an income tax group a couple of years down the line.
Thank you. So, Madam Chair, there's an indeterminate fiscal note for an income tax and an indeterminate number of state employees that would have to be increased to implement the tax.
Through the chair, that's a fair statement.
Thank you. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Mr. Alper, for that presentation. I was going through my packet here, and I was hoping I would see some kind of modeling or analysis that would show what economic impact these tax increases is going to have to Alaskans and to the local economies. You know, we often take the perspective here that, well, what's best for government? How can we're going to hire more government employees, it sounds like, with an income tax. and we're going to get $300 million more in taxes. But what does this do to our fragile economies in our communities? My community, Anchorage, where thousands of oil workers have been laid off, now they're going to pay more in a fuel tax, or a lot of small diners are going to not sell that extra glass of wine with dinner because the tax is going to double. And our alcohol tax, for example, is already the highest in the nation, and now we're going to double it just because we need the money. But my perspective is, what is this going to do to these small businesses that rely on that extra glass of wine or margarita to sell it at the dinner?
Through the chair, President Meyer, of course, this presentation was designed to be a higher overview, but with full disclosure, we don't have a lot of that type of modeling. We certainly do on the income tax, which is the largest piece of it. ICER did a 92-page study on the impact of various taxes and cuts, but the taxes that they dealt with were the broad-based taxes, the income tax and the sales tax. They didn't drill down to the individual smaller excise and other taxes that are in here. So, we can provide as much as we have in a future hearing. We certainly can make some general statements on what we think the outcome may be. For instance, the motor fuel tax. You know, it's an 8-cent increase. When I came down here in January, the tax in Anchorage was just a little over $2, or the price of a gallon of gas in Anchorage was a little over $2. I went back last weekend for a couple of days, and it was $2.38. So, I mean, the price of gas has gone up 30 cents a gallon just because of the commodity prices. So I think largely an 8-cent increase in the motor fuel tax would largely disappear in the noise of motor fuel tax for the individual taxpayer. Certainly, it has a little bit more of an issue for the airline industry or the trucking industry that does become an ongoing price for them. And we've had letters of support from various groups, both within the aviation industry and the trucking industry. Recently, the trucking industry has pulled back on their support, primarily because they felt like the motor fuel tax, I think, was the one that was moving fastest, and they felt like they were kind of being singled out because the other taxes weren't moving along and the Permanent Fund Protection Act wasn't moving along. At least that seemed to be the tenor of the letter. So I think a lot of these groups recognize that there is a need, that we do need stability. But for us to be able to tell you that what the direct economic impact would be on an individual business because of some of these, we simply don't have that data.
Thank you. Follow up?
Senator Meyer?
Yep, and thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate that. And I think that's the problem with the omnibus bill here is because, you know, maybe a fuel tax isn't that big a deal to folks here in Juneau because you're limited on where you can drive. But, you know, if I lived in Palmer and drove back and forth to Anchorage every day, it's 100 miles a day, and you're doubling my fuel tax, that I'm going to feel that, and that's a concern. The other question I have, well, and you brought up the ICER report is basically the only analysis or modeling that you've done, and I don't have that report in front of me, but when we compared, forgot the person, the economist that did the report, Goldsmith? No.
Dr. Gunnar Knapp.
Yeah. When Dr. Knapp made the presentation and we had the ICER report, it actually looked like the sales tax was a better way to go than an income tax, assuming you made exemptions for, you know, medicine and food and et cetera. But that's not even before us. And don't get me wrong, I'm not advocating for sales tax. But I think, if I remember, one of his comments was to do nothing would hurt the economy, but to do everything would hurt it even worse, I believe. Am I misquoting him?
Senator Meyer, he did say that when he came in to the committee that doing nothing is equally as bad as doing everything.
Yeah, and that's
at the same time.
And that's what we're proposing here, is to do everything. But let me ask you another question, because in these different taxes, we address tax credits. And obviously tax credits has been another big subject this session, and now this special session. There was a tobacco tax credit, I think, a mining exploration tax credit, but I didn't see any fish tax credits. And I know we have several, because I think just 3 or 4 years ago we passed one for canned herring or salmon or something that mostly was for Kodiak area. It was Representative who was it?
Stutes.
No, Osterman's bill. Have you thought about doing maybe an omnibus tax credit bill that would include the oil and gas tax credit, you know, the tobacco, the mining, and fish?
Madam Chair, President Meyer, no, we didn't really look at an omnibus tax credit bill. You know, we're aware that there are some of those other credits out there. But actually, I don't ever remember that even coming up as in the discussion of doing an omnibus credit bill. I do want to, if I could, just address a couple of the other comments that you made. The sales tax, I think, was definitely something the governor considered. And in fact, I think for the most of the time the process, it kind of led the way as being the governor's preferred option for a broad-based tax. But when it came right down to the end, when it really turned out that the income tax seemed to be a better balance against the reduction in the size of the permanent fund dividend, just because of the regressive, progressive nature of the two different taxes. And so ultimately that, plus being able to capture some of the S-corps and some of the outside income and a few other things, ultimately the governor chose to do the income tax instead. But I think we were largely fairly neutral on the difference between the two. They both would achieve the goal, and they both have their pros and cons. And as far as the statements that Professor Knapp made, he did say that he thought that if we did everything in 1 year, that might be more than the economy could. Handle, but he did also indicate that the parts that we didn't do, people needed to know what the plan was to finish the job, so that it would take the uncertainty out of the equation. Because one of the things we've heard a lot from the business owners around the state is that the uncertainty of what happens next is really important in their whether they make capital investments or not. If we leave 20% unresolved, they have to continue to wonder, are they going to be the 20% that happens the next year? And that makes it difficult for them to invest. So even if all this wasn't put in play immediately, the people need to know kind of what the ultimate solution is, so that they can adjust accordingly and not have to wait until all the pieces finally get resolved. So, yes, I mean, everything in place all at once, Professor Knapp definitely said that would be too much for the economy. But he also did say people need to know what the ultimate solution is as well.
Go ahead, Mr. Yeah. Alper.
Madam Chair, just Senator Meyer talked about doing everything. The all of these taxes changes, with the exception of the income tax, are changes to an existing process. We have the people in place. We're changing some numbers. We're not adding any staff, anything. We're just going to be collecting more money and whatever the impacts might be. The income tax, as Senator Giesel's question went in that direction, is a big lift, a big new implementation, new staff, new process. So would a sales tax. A sales tax would be a large staff increment, outreach to every small business in the state and all of that. So the least efficient thing we could do would be both. To have a small income tax and a small sales tax would mean you have to add two new bureaucracies instead of one. So should the legislature get to where they're ready to make the step towards a statewide tax, I would advise that we pick one or the other and not both, because there is a risk to doing everything at the same time, to Senator Meyer's question.
Madam Chairman?
Senator Meyer?
Just for the record, I'm not advocating either one, let alone both of them, but... May I continue, or do you?
Certainly, Senator
okay.
Meyer.
Thank you. I like, you know, we have heard some of these bills in this committee, as you mentioned, but there's a couple we have not. One of them is the fish tax, and I have to tell you, I'm not familiar with the fishing industry whatsoever, so these questions are more to educate me, and I apologize for my ignorance on the subject. But I always get concerned when somebody wants to be exempted from a tax. And I noticed that you're removing the fish cruise from withholding tax, and I think your comment was because they found it too onerous. Can you tell me why that would be more onerous than, say, a small contractor?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, that comment had to do with the income tax, not with the fish tax.
Right.
So the question is who withholds. And if you're an employer with normal wage employees where you're already withholding federal income tax and FICA tax, that's the obvious case where you would be also withholding the Alaskan income tax and remitting it to the state. The bill is originally written, and it goes back once again to the 1970s income tax, was that crew shares, meaning the lump sum payments that fish captains give their crew, would also have a withholding component. And my guess, frankly, of the reason for that is these are large lump sums of people, many of whom are non-resident, and you want to make sure that they pay their taxes, that they don't take it out of state and you never hear from them again. But what we heard from representatives from fishing areas or from the industry themselves is that would be a severe paperwork burden for fish captains who don't really have employees. They don't do the other forms of withholding, therefore shouldn't be forced to do the Alaska state income tax withholding. The crew would still have to pay the tax. The burden remains. Presumably they have a federal tax liability. They would have a state tax liability. What we removed from the bill is the requirement that they pay the withholding tax in advance of filing their taxes.
Yeah. Madam Chair, just
Commissioner Hoffbeck,
take that just a little bit further. The reason behind that is essentially those crews are contract employees, and so they would still get a 1099. They would still be treated as a contract employee, but not as a salaried employee. And that's kind of the information we got from the fishing industry. Is that really is the status of the crews there, that they're contract employees, not salary employees?
Okay. And if I can continue, actually, my question. Next question does have to do with the fishing industry. If I can continue,
Senator Meyer,
you mentioned that the tax would most likely impact the fishermen, that the processor would push back that tax to the fishermen. But doesn't everybody just? I mean, it's a commodity, just like oil. It goes up and down. Doesn't the processor ultimately just pass that tax to the consumer? I mean, isn't the consumer the one that's going to pay for this fish tax ultimately?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, and I'm not terribly knowledgeable about the ins and outs of the fish processing industry either, but the commodity is the downstream price. These processes are selling generally in bulk to wholesalers, to people. You know, it ends up in the restaurant industry or in the retail stores. So that's a commodity set price. Our fish is competing against fish from elsewhere in the world, and the different tax regimes aren't necessarily influencing the price that they can charge. As opposed to, and I use the example of alcohol, if we add another dollar to the price of a bottle of booze at the wholesale level, they're going to sell it to the liquor store and build in that dollar, and that's just going to be the price, and then they're going to pass it on to the retail customer, and likely there's a markup on that dollar along the way. It might be $2 or $3 by the time it gets to you or me at the store. Because the fish processor can't necessarily automatically get that markup, they might be reducing the prices that they're paying the fishermen that they're buying the fish from is how they're going to get that money back. That's the concern that was raised, and there's likely some truth to that.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And before we move on to Senator Seams, I just wanted to mention something that's said over and over again is going from 4% to 5% is a 1% increase, when in fact a 1% increase to 4% would be 0.04. When you go from 4% to 5%, it is a 25% increase. And we hear this over and over again, and the school teacher in me wants to correct that, so I'm correcting it. I think it's just important that when we talk about the taxes that we're trying to be as accurate as possible, because when it's characterized in a way as, oh, this is just a 1%, it perhaps doesn't – it's just simply not mathematically accurate. But
Madam Chair, could I say something that I think you might get a kick out of in response to that?
Sure. We can have some fun on this tax.
I know that the governor likes to listen into these hearings. I received a phone call from the governor the day before this bill got introduced, and he wanted to correct the transmittal letter that I had marked up a little in the first draft of it, because I had said a 1% increase, and he wanted to clarify 1 percentage point increase for that exact reason, because he didn't want to confuse that it was it is in fact more than one. It is, if it's 4 to 5, it's a 25% increase, but that's why the transmittal says 1 percentage point increase, because the governor made the same observation you did.
Thank you, and I appreciate that. Senator Stevens.
Thank you. I appreciate the discussion of the fish.
I knew you would, Senator Stevens.
I will comment on the comments that were made, but I would like to go ahead and talk a little bit more about the issue of the landing fees and the municipal revenue sharing. I mean, it seems to me like we had a rationale at one time that we were sharing those landing fees with the communities because they're the ones who have the costs. They have the boat harbors, which the state now has returned, or not returned, but forced communities to take over. So we now in our communities, boroughs and cities, pay for those sorts of things. So there's a rationale there for sharing that landing tax with the municipalities, but now you've dumped that with this. I guess my question is, if it was rational to share it with communities at one point, why is it not rational to share this additional tax with the communities?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, there's no specific reason we're not increasing the costs on communities by raising the taxes. So the incremental tax could also be shared. There was something of a revenue goal in this. When we put together the package, the broader idea was, you know, as part of the overall picture, we'd like to get another $15 to $20 million in GF out of the commercial fishery. Now that number got backed out from, and I don't recall if I had the conversation in this committee, I've discussed it, or elsewhere in the session. If you look at the general fund portion of the state's fish taxes, it's around $25 million a year, all in. And there's a lot of other fish taxes that are dedicated in some way, the marketing tax, the dive fish management tax, that sort of thing. But these are GF taxes. We got about $25 million. If you go to the Department of Fish and Game Commercial Fisheries Division, their GF budget is about $40 million. So, and effectively, there's a certain amount of general fund subsidy of the commercial fishery, or at least the argument could be made. So we wanted to be able to at least raise enough from the industry to make them neutral to the state, that they were paying their own way of their own management and administration. So we wanted a $15 to $20 million increment. If we were going to do that and split it 50 to 50, we would need a 2 percentage point increase in the tax rate and then give half of it to the municipalities. So that's the short form reason. I think the industry would probably complain twice as much if we went in that direction.
Senator Giesel?
No, that's fine. I don't like the answer, but it's fine.
Through the chair, I'm sorry, Senator Steve.
Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a point of clarification, we heard both fisheries and mining in the Resources Committee, and it didn't move, neither tax moved out of our two committees, or our committee, by the way. But returning to the mining tax, have altered the tax holiday, and I believe that, as I recall, we asked for modeling of the effect of that on a new mine when revenue presented to the Resources Committee. I don't know that we ever got that. So what is the effect to move from 3.5-year tax holiday to 2-year for a company that's starting out a new mine to recuperate their costs and begin to actually make a profit?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, I'm sorry that we don't have the modeling. What we have heard is that the early years are relatively low profit years for a mine because they're still building out their initial construction, their equipment, their main shafts. That wasn't the big piece of the benefit. The mining tax, I mentioned the exploration credit. The development costs are also capitalized through a process called the depletion allowance. We had some discussion of this in the House Resources Committee, that depletion is capitalized and then depleted, or it's a form of depreciation, really. They take those costs and they apply them over multiple years against their profits. And that tends to reduce the tax burden, and that is by far a bigger component of how they're recouping their costs. So the 3.5-year to 2-year is, we couldn't find any history to where the 3.5-year from, and we heard that not that much gets paid in the early years anyway. I could say that the mining bill did move from the House Resources Committee with a 3-year tax holiday. It reduced the 3.5 to 3. So we were in some ways trying to split the difference.
Okay, I'll check with the industry and see
sure.
how they balance those out. So I notice on page 16, how does it impact Alaskans? You point out that there's only 14 taxpayers that actually make more than $100,000 a year. So that, I think, is a really good illustration that this is not a large industry in our state, and it's not a high-income industry either. I mean, if there's only 14 of them making more than $100,000. So what effect would the changes you're making in this mining tax have on, say, a producing mine that's been going for some time, like Fort Knox? Do you have any idea what that impact would look like?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, I think we might have provided to your committee, and we'll provide it to this one, the report that lays out the number of taxpayers by bracket over the last couple of years. It's an interesting report because although there's 14 of them, the total income of those 14 entities was $200-something million, is the number off the top of my head. It is a relatively large industry, but that number is concentrated in a relatively small number even within the, you know, if we had a $100,000 bracket and then $1 million bracket and we could report it separately, we'd be able to parse it out a little bit better, and the number would get even smaller and the number would be concentrated at the top. We have these five large mines, Fort Knox, Pogo, Greens Creek, of course, Red Dog, et cetera. So we can't talk about the impact on an individual company, but if a company, you know, I said the total was a couple $100 million. If a company makes $10 million over the course of a year, which would be less than one-fifth of that, so a small or large mine, a 2% increase of $10 million would be a $200,000 tax increase for that company. So that's what the impact would be. How would that $200,000 be absorbed? You know, those companies are much more reactive to the price of their commodity than anything else. I mean, no one scoffs at $200,000. That's a lot of money. But realistically, their profits are going to be moving up and down a lot faster with what the price of gold is than with what our 2% tax increase, 2 percentage point tax increase is, which is a 28% tax increase from 7 to 9 on their marginal profits. Obviously, I can't speak to an individual taxpayer.
Yeah. Understood. I'm guessing then you probably haven't figured out how this might impact a mine like Donlin, which hasn't started up yet.
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, the tax holiday provision, because there aren't any large mines in the pipeline expected to open in the next 6 years, did not have any impact in the fiscal note. If we had any coming, there would have been an impact to it. I imagine that they would have an opinion on how long that tax holiday needs to be. Likewise, the application of our statute about how the depletion works and our statute over how the exploration credits works. Our mining taxes could use a generational overhaul, in my opinion. They have not been changed to a significant degree in decades, and Alaska's modern era of these large industrial mines, kind of post the early industrial mines that helped build Alaska, like that helped build our city here, Juneau, there was an era where there wasn't a lot of mining in Alaska other than the small so-called mom-and-pop placer mining, and now we have a second wave of large mines. Our mining tax statutes have never adapted to meet that structure, and this tax is just scratching the surface. I'm sure there's a lot of things we could and should do differently for mining.
Senator Giesel?
So in resources, we had a presentation of a research paper on the economics of three industries, mining, tourism, I believe it was tourism, and commercial fishing. And one of the things it demonstrated was the very large amount of revenue that is generated from the mining industry through the various permits as well as the tax, compared to the cost to state government for regulating that significant industry. So I'll provide that to you. You might find it interesting. The state of Alaska takes in far more than it costs to regulate mining. And in fact, you speculate here that this mining tax would bring in $9 million. I wanted to point out that one of the bills that was passed recently through both bodies was the hunting, fishing, and trapping license fee increase. That's projected to bring in $9 million a year, more than this tax, and leverage about $25 million of federal money. That wasn't even proposed by the governor. It actually came from a legislator. So thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Senator Stevens?
You only briefly mentioned the, you say, also tax, I'm talking about income tax, it also taxes out-of-state income, partnership, and S-corporations. I wonder if you could go into a little more detail on what we expect in terms of revenue from out-of-state taxpayers. That's the one thing when I go back home, I hear from my community, mm-hmm. people say, well, that sounds okay. That sounds okay to finally receive some tax money from fishermen who deliver to Seattle and never come ashore in Alaska, and the oil company employees who fly out and don't pay any taxes. So can you give me an idea of how much you're talking about? And then an additional issue, but just throw it in here if you'd answer it as well, is we have a lot of pollock fishermen, fisheries that never comes ashore. That's from the federal waters. I assume those taxes are only paid when they deliver income tax. I don't know. The state, does Alaska receive any funds from offshore fisheries?
Now, through the chair, Senator Stevens, yes, our land, should that fish be landed, and many of the pollock is landed, say, in the port of Dutch Harbor, we receive the landing tax on that. If you were to look at the state's the Department of Revenue shared tax report, which it's not just fisheries, but the aviation fuel, all the shared taxes, cruise ships. If you look at the breakdown of the landing tax, the several million dollars we share with municipalities, it's very Dutch Harbor-centric. That's by far the largest line item in it, and that indicates that a lot of that fishery is passing through there. As to the out-of-state, there's something of a barbell income curve to the non-resident employees. There's certain high-wage employees, certain fisheries people, and then the oil company people. There's also a fair amount of low-wage people, seasonal tourism workers being that, or some of the cannery workers. Seasonal cannery workers would be a good example of that. So there's a little bit of, based on that, is their average income about equal to the average Alaskan? And then what's the percentage of the workforce that's non-resident? We have some somewhat high-level modeling. We don't have it pinned down as much as we would like, but at the high end, 10 to 15% of the money would come from non-residents. And then there's also those Alaskans who might work part-time out of state, who might have property out of state that they earn income from, and they would be able to apportion their income tax liability between Alaska and that other state. So there's a little bit of a leakage in the other direction in this formulation. And when we talk about what's it going to cost to run an income tax, if Alaska was a closed box and everyone stayed here all the time, it would be a postcard. It would be the easiest income tax of all. If you pay the federal tax, pay us the difference. All of that staff is going to be about the fine points of differentiating in-state from out-of-state income. That's probably where 90% of the workload of actually administering this tax is going to be.
Commissioner Hoffbeck.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, just on the landing tax portion, if a fish are caught within Alaska's economic zone, even if they're landed in Seattle, we still tax those fish. So the landing tax does extend beyond our borders if the fish are caught within our economic zone. And if you ask me how, I will have to get somebody else up here to give you more details on that.
And the income tax, then how does that work? I mean, if they deliver to Seattle, for example, is income tax paid in Alaska on the fish caught here? It's an unanswerable question, I understand.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, obviously that would be something we would have to develop through regulation. But if the income is earned in Alaska, and again, if they're caught within the Alaska economic zone, I suspect that our regulations would say that is an income that we would tax.
And Madam Chair, if I could follow up, I just want to make sure that I understood partnerships and S-corps as well before we leave the out-of-state.
I'll try. Through the chair, Senator Stevens, if a non-resident owns an Alaska, a corporation or a partnership in Alaska that earns income here,
and they have their federal tax liability is based on, let's say, they had a $100,000 income between their job where they live and some business that they get a share of from Alaska. There would be some sort of apportionment that those Alaska originating incomes would, there would be a formula by which their income tax would be considered a percentage Alaska, and they would owe that piece to Alaska. So S corporations are not, they're exempted from the Alaskan income tax, the corporate income tax that we have right now, not because we're specifically exempting them. It's that the S corporation, by its nature, doesn't retain its own profits. It doesn't hold them. They're passed through in a distribution form, a Schedule K, to their owners, and then the owner pays those taxes on their personal income tax. So that's the way they flow naturally. So the way, and we have a lot of large S corporations. It's a growing type, including some of our oil companies are now S corporations who don't pay the corporate income tax. But their owners, those earnings would be taxable under that individual's personal income tax. The key is the legal terms are things like nexus and situs. And like, where is the thing itself located where the income derives from? So even if I don't live here, but I own an oil company that works in Alaska, my revenue is coming from here. But alternatively, if I live here but I own something out of state, I don't pay taxes on it so long as I can control it. What the tax administration gets to, like if I own stock but I don't actually run the company, that doesn't count. That's just my income. But if I own a company that does business in another state and the income is derived there, then it wouldn't be taxable in Alaska.
Commissioner Hoffbeck?
Madam Chair, just to clarify for the record, because I'm sure some people just cringed, it's not Exxon, BP, or ConocoPhillips that doesn't pay corporate income tax. If a company is publicly traded, it is a C corp. It does pay our corporate income tax. It would be companies that are not publicly traded that could be incorporated as an S corp and would thereby not have to pay the state corporate income tax.
And Senator Stevens?
I'm sorry, just as the last thing I'll say, but if I understand it, what you said, 10-15% in order to be non-Alaskans, out of the $100 million in 18, the $205 million in 19, we're talking about $10 to $30 million.
Through the chair, yeah, that's about what we estimate.
Thank you.
Mr. Alper, so I'm glad you mentioned the tax liability for those small business owners would be seen on their personal income tax. And it's my understanding that the federal government is planning to no longer, or there's a movement to no longer allow your state taxes to be written off. And I'm just curious, it's my understanding we'd be the only state if we pass this with an income tax where it's a percentage of your federal. And if then, can you just comment on that if you're also aware of that?
Madam Chairman, I'm not aware of the change. That would obviously be a national change. I think there are one or two states that still use the percentage of federal, and we've had conversation in other forums, but there's a little bit of a circular logic to that, but I think there's a year's delay or the formulas somehow rebalance themselves. Our income tax bill is based on our historic income tax, which was, again, repealed 36 years ago. There has been some modernization in income tax law since then. There's been major federal tax reform, several rounds of major federal tax reform. The most states tax as a percentage of adjusted gross income, which is a number higher up on the form. It would be what it would amount to a smaller percentage of a larger number. The equivalent number for this bill, about 1% of adjusted gross income, on the average works out to 6% of the liability. But the implementation of it is different because if you went with a flat percentage, it would be a flat tax. It wouldn't be a progressive tax. Now, part of the decision to go with a percentage of liability was, one, we had the statute, we had law to work from, our old law, even though we recognize that it probably needs to get modernized, and should it pass, we would probably have technical amendments as well as a fiscal note to bring before the legislature next year. And part of it was it makes the debate over a tax one very important step more complicated. What are the tax brackets going to be? Are we going to have additional exemptions? Are we get this type of income or that type of income or 4% of the amount over 50,000 or 3%? Like all of a sudden you get into a progressivity fight in addition to are we going to have an income tax fight? And it just makes it one step more complicated. And that's why the governor's decision was to go with a flat rate tax tied to the federal return, although, frankly, it would be in many ways a cleaner and more comparable to other states to go to a tax based on adjusted gross income.
And certainly, Mr. Alper, we've had these conversations when the bill came in the regular session before Labor and Commerce. There's, for the ease of the taxpayer, the system that is proposed is easier. However, can you comment on the concern that we would, if this were to pass in this manner, assuming you get the votes, the concern about tying our taxes to a federal rate, because then we're essentially tied to the federal increase if that were to occur.
Madam Chair, that's quite a reasonable thing to say. If the feds should, for whatever reason, double their income tax, we would be doubling ours at the same time, whereas if our tax was tied to the individual's income, there wouldn't be that indirect or unanticipated impact. That is totally reasonable. We did not have last fall easy access to income tax based on adjusted gross income. And then there's a couple of other different wrinkles in there, but there was a bill that almost passed one of the bodies for a sales tax about a dozen years ago, and a lot of exemptions got added into it late. It became almost a free-for-all of how do you carve pieces out of it, and that's some of our anxiety about going in that direction, whereas this bill is an all or nothing. It's like it's taxed based as a percentage of your income. You can't build credits and exemptions into it, but in many ways, you're absolutely right. Detaching ourselves from the federal tax code is probably a safer bet going forward. And should the bill not pass this session, and I'm by no means giving up on it, but should we come back next year with an income tax, I wouldn't be surprised to see it structured differently.
And I just want to end my questioning just to circle back around to something that was mentioned earlier. It seems like first, starting with looking at a comprehensive look at the exemptions that we're giving right now, the revenue that we're foregoing, and we've done that with one major industry in Alaska, but it's, the state has many tax exemptions, and it seems like a good first place would be to look at those, at the same time, perhaps, or prior to a comprehensive new tax system. And it's my understanding from looking at the report that the state has that there's quite a bit of foregone revenue that we could capture. Is that, and you mentioned earlier that wasn't something that the administration had considered, but would you be willing to look at that?
Madam Chair, absolutely. The document I believe you're referring to is the Indirect Expenditures Report. There was a House bill that passed two or three years ago that mandated that we do that report. It was a very interesting and illuminating result. Several of the low-hanging fruit pieces of that did actually get turned into a bill by one of the co-chairs of House Finance. I believe that bill came through and passed out of your committee, although it did not pass the Senate at the end of the day. But there's a lot out there. There's corporate income tax credits. There's some tobacco tax credits. There's a lot of things that we would like to address. It's hard because they're buried deep in statute, and there's a lot of small line items. And just like a big bill like this, everything has its defenders and has its pushback. But we would like very much to clean up our tax code, especially on the corporate income side, over the next couple of years and fix as much of that as possible.
Thank you. Are there any further questions of committee members?
Madam Chair.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could just get a clarification on a question Senator Stevens asked, because we all hear this frequently that we need an income tax so we can get these out-of-state workers. And it is frustrating to be on a plane and be sitting next to somebody who's, working with the tourism industry or fishing or oil, and they don't live in our state but have a job in our state. So you said that 15% of the income collected is from out-of-state workers. Is that correct?
Through the chair, President Meyer, yes. The total wage income of Alaskans, the latest data I've seen, is about $22 billion, and about $3 billion of that is earned by non-resident workers.
Okay. And then, again, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think you said that 90% of the manpower necessary to collect an income tax is because of these out-of-state workers.
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, not just those out-of-state workers, but those Alaskans who might also have some income deriving from out-of-state sources that wouldn't be taxable here.
Okay. And then how many Madam Chair, if I can continue.
Senator Meyer.
I think in a fiscal note we had on this, on an income tax in committee before, we were estimating about 50 employees would be necessary.
President Meyer, through the chair, it was 60, with 16 of them being part-time, those being the data processing, the data entry people that would have a slug of work when the returns came in and not be working year-round. So 52 FTEs in the language of the bureaucracy.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. It's frustrating, too, because some of the feedback we get is, well, why would you want to hire another 60 state employees to take money away from us when you got another group of employees giving it back to us via the dividend? And I don't have a good answer for that, and I don't think you do either. So.
No, the only answer to that, Mr. President, through the chair, is some degree of balance, that by reducing everyone's dividend equally is something of a regressive tax. The lowest income Alaskans get impacted by a relatively large percentage of their income. The highest income Alaskans, a much smaller percentage, and a progressive income tax, depending on the rate and the slope, could balance that out and equalize the benefit percentage-wise across the Alaskan population.
Thank you, Mr. Elber. I appreciate that, but bottom line is that we create a huge bureaucracy when we do the income tax and the dividend, which we all like the dividend, but it does require people to distribute that. So, okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And finally, if there's any long-term economic modeling, I know when Dr. Gunnar Knapp came before the committee, he had presented some short-term, but if there's any long-term that you are able to provide to us, that would be greatly appreciated. And I did want to thank the members for coming today for this important bill, and mention that for anyone listening online or any members of the public who wish to provide any comments on the bill, please feel free to submit those to myself, and I'll share those with the committee and the administration. So with that, the meeting's adjourned.